Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, adult stem cells saved my life. Dying from leukemia 14 years ago, this man's alive to tell his story today thanks to groundbreaking stem cell therapy, an ethical treatment supported by the Church. And Vatican Radio speaks Arabic. We talked to the new director of the Arabic program about his new job. He calls himself the Miracle Man, but good science and a lot of good luck may have had more to do with his recovery from leukemia than a true miracle.
A man touched by God and by miracles in more than one.
Stephen Sprague was diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia back in 1995. Doctors tried everything to cure him, including months of chemotherapy. He was on a waiting list for a bone marrow transplant when his disease took a turn for the worse. An only child with no siblings, there were no donors available, and none in the registries matched his type.
I was diagnosed with a chronic kind of leukemia, which they told me, you know, you've got 3 or 4 or 5 years before you really have to start to worry. So I said, okay, I can deal with that. A year and a half after diagnosis, I went from the first stage to the blast crisis stage, the end stage of this process. It took them 6 weeks to get me into remission, and in those 6 weeks, they conducted a bone marrow search. That's all there was. That was the only option for transplant in 1997.
In other words, to find a donor who would give his bone marrow.
Yes, mm-hmm. A live donor who would come and give up his bone marrow for a stranger. And the registry wasn't very big back then, a couple of million maybe. But, you know, you think that somebody's got to be a match for you. This is a big country. But HLA matching, I've learned, HLA is like a fingerprint. And no two are alike. You can get close, but if you have a large mismatch, then the transplant will not be a success.
HLA stands for?
Human leukocyte antigens. And everybody has its own set, and they're different for every person.
And I understand that even within families, even siblings or parents don't necessarily share all of these certain characteristics that are necessary.
Right. Siblings probably have a 30% chance of matching. I was an only child, so, you know, that took care of that. And then there's often or sometimes matches within the family. But you're still left with probably half the patients that need transplant have no related match, so they have to look for an unrelated match, mm-hmm. The needle in the haystack.
But as Stephen's luck would have it, an unknown woman in New York decided to donate her baby's umbilical cord after birth.
She was at a hospital that had a cord blood collection program. And I'm sure they asked her, would you be willing to donate? Obviously, she said yes. She, to this day, has no idea what she's done. Part of the donation process is that the mother and child remain anonymous.
Because of the anonymous donation process, that woman will never know that thanks to her, Stephen Sprague was completely cured of leukemia and was alive 14 years later to tell his story to participants at a November conference in the Vatican on the therapeutic potential of adult stem cells. That's where I met him.
You said that you received this treatment back in 1997.
Right.
That was the year my son was born.
Really?
And I have to say, I didn't even really know about donating placenta or the cord blood.
No mothers did. This was in the early, early days when only a few mothers, and they had to be in the right city to be able to even do what somebody asked them if they would do. You know, mothers get asked, would you mind if we didn't throw this away and we stored it for use by anybody that needed it? And what mother would say no?
Well, that mother's yes meant Stephen was able to see his kids grow up, marry, and have kids of their own. That mother's donation of cord blood ended up in the laboratories of Dr. Andrew Pecora and his team of researchers at Hackensack University Medical Center in New Jersey, where they were conducting the first clinical trials using cord blood as an alternative source of stem cells to bone marrow. By the fall of 1997, Stephen had been told to get his affairs in order. He had only weeks to live. But again, as luck would have it, he was given his last chance to enroll in Dr. Pecora's clinical trial.
Yes, that's correct. So my background is I'm a bone marrow transplant doctor by training. I'm an oncologist and hematologist, and I treat people with cancer, including leukemia. And Mr. Stephen Sprague, who's now actually world famous because of his life experience, he had a form of leukemia that there was no cure for other than a bone marrow transplant. Unfortunately for him, he was a very large man at the time, and he didn't have a brother or sister. He was an only child. And when we did a donor search through the unrelated donor registry, there were no matches. The only match we could find was an umbilical cord blood, but there were not enough cells in it for a man of Mr. Sprague's size. So we were very fortunate in that we were doing an experimental trial where we were using a new device that hadn't been proven, where we took cord blood, expanded it in a device outside of the body for 14 days, and that grew up enough cells from that umbilical cord blood that we then went forward with the transplant with Mr. Sprague, and the rest is history.
But so few patients can actually get into a trial like that. And he was so grateful to you that you didn't give up on him because he presented so many challenges. He had diabetes, he had a cardiac condition, he was overweight. You have to turn so many people away from these kinds of experiments.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I think it's a matter of the center. I'm very fortunate. I work at the John Thorah Cancer Center in Hackensack, New Jersey. We're a very progressive place. We're a place of innovation. And there are many places like that around the globe where people can seek out this kind of care. To Mr. Sprague's credit, when he was told to go home and put his affairs in order, he was not ready to do that. He had a daughter that he was raising, and he sought us out. So there are places in the world, and I would advise any patient faced with that situation to continue to always explore all of your options.
The state of transplantation at that point was that if you couldn't find the match as a doctor, you watched your patient die. So there were a certain number of doctors who that was not satisfactory. So they started looking at cord blood as a way to find an alternative source of stem cells. But the results in the early days were dismal. So the industry, you know, expecting better results, was not supportive of this new way to transplant a patient. So it took 5 years of dedication from a handful of doctors, several who are here today, to be determined to find an alternative to bone marrow because they didn't want to watch their patients, just have no other option.
And of course, you've been following the research in this field today. What gives you hope for the future?
Well, we know that adult stem cells work. There's been a lot of discussion about embryonic stem cells. They are not in patient application. It's never been tried. It's quite far away from ever being used, and a lot of speculation as to whether it will ever work at all. So here you've got adult stem cells, which have been proven to work for 20 years now. You know, so we're on the cutting edge. For adult stem cell applications, we've already seen 20 years, 12 years of progress. The new applications for stem cells, adult stem cells, is just amazing. You know, it's not going to be surgery. It's going to be stem cell applications to regrow diseased limbs, to deal with diabetes, to deal with heart problems, to deal with all of those diseases that are so horrific.
You have a vademecum of ideas for the future, where all of this should go. What needs to be done in order to make this kind of adult stem cell treatment available in all kinds of health fields for more and more people? How do you think that society, governments, doctors need to tackle this problem?
It's gotten much better. There's probably no transplant center that cannot do a cord blood transplant. There's not enough inventory to match every patient that needs a stem cell transplant. So first of all, the inventory has to be increased. More mothers have to donate. More average citizens need to become bone marrow donors. It costs nothing to be a bone marrow donor. It costs a lot to collect a donated cord blood unit and put it in the freezer. The patient doesn't pay. The mother doesn't pay. The people that pay are the cord blood banks that are working to build a public inventory. They only get recovery when one of their collected units gets selected for transplant. Then they get recovery from insurance. So we have successfully convinced the government to fund
the United States government.
United States government to fund public cord blood banking. Not a lot of money, $15 million, and it was renewed again after 5 years. So we've got the government engaged in trying to help the financial costs of donating cord blood, but it's nowhere near adequate. So we need the government to find more money. We need to find cost-efficient ways to collect and store. And, you know, the mothers are convinced that they are willing to do this. So that used to be the problem. That's no longer the problem.
You said another thing today, that you could be recognized by this badge you're wearing.
Yes.
Adult stem cells saved my life.
You know, when you're a parent, you watch for your children to grow and marry and family, grandkids. When someone says to you, you're never going to see that. So, you know, prepare. And then all of a sudden, you get it all back. And you see both children marry well to a son-in-law and a daughter-in-law who I like. And you start to see grandchildren. I had my fifth just last year. And, you know, when you are able to give in the gift to watch all this, it is it's hard to describe.
You were sort of given another lease on life.
Yeah,
another,
absolutely.
And gave you a new perspective, a new way of looking at life.
Well, you know, I was a busy labor union executive. I thought I had an important job, working for the rights of professional musicians to earn a decent livelihood. And I did that for 20 years. I did it in Times Square. I put in 80 hours a week. I thought I had an important job. I never went back. So when you realize what is important and what true meaning of life is all about, then you decide that you're going to try to be an advocate for the next patient that is going down the path that you went down and try to make it a little easier for them. There were no people like that when I was transplanted. So it is a rewarding day, every day.
What do you think about this Vatican-sponsored conference here?
I've never been to the Vatican. I'm not a Catholic. But first of all, to see the city, the Vatican City, and to see how Catholicism operates, and then to know you have the power of the Pope behind something that really makes a difference to life. It's rewarding, it's encouraging, it's what we need, what the patient community needs is somebody to care about them. They have the medical community, they have the family support. Now they need the religious support to support something that will really have an impact on their life and the life. You know, this is a family disease, so it touches everybody in the family. And that would make a big difference in the quality of life of regular, normal people who get diagnosed with no warning.
Today, Dr. Andrew Pecora is Chief Medical Officer of NeoStem, a U.S.-based biotech company that has partnered with the Pontifical Council for Culture in the promotion of research into adult stem cells. His own research has taken him now into the realm of stem cell treatment for cardiac patients.
There is a significant percentage of people who have heart attacks that are large enough that it doesn't kill them, but it hurts their hearts enough that for the rest of their life, their hearts are going to be a problem. We have developed a stem cell therapy that looks like, out of phase one, now we're going into phase two, that looks like it's able to prevent the heart from being damaged over time from a big heart attack, and we're pretty excited about it.
Where are you sourcing these adult stem cells from?
So they actually come from the bone marrow of the patient who had the heart attack. People who have heart attacks go to their local emergency rooms wherever they are in the world. The standard of care is to open up the blocked artery. Once the blocked artery is opened up, in some countries stents are placed and others not, patients are put on medicines and sent home. About 4 to 5 days after the heart attack, we take patients to a procedure where we take some bone marrow from their hip. It takes about 20 minutes. They don't go to the operating room. They're wide awake. And we send those cells to a laboratory where we pull out a unique cell type that's able, once reinfused in the person's body, to regenerate blood vessels in the area of damaged heart tissue. And the way we give the cells is a cardiologist will place the cells in the coronary artery where the heart attack was caused. The cells are infused. Some 10 to 20 days later, you start to see new blood vessel growth. And 6 months later, the heart is working better instead of getting worse over time, which would otherwise be the case.
Trials like Dr. Pecora's are going on the world over. Researchers using adult stem cells say they have successfully treated vascular disorders in patients who otherwise would have had a leg or an arm amputated. They've successfully regenerated skin tissue that refuses to heal, to treat autoimmune diseases, and even regrow entire organs.
We've been giving stem cells to people for over 50 years in the context of blood and marrow stem cell transplant. Every year around the world, close to 20 to 25,000 people get stem cells infused in their bodies to treat otherwise incurable diseases. Over the last 5 to 7 years, there's been an explosion, first in the knowledge and then in the application, of cells that are either from our own body or from somebody else's. Infused into body parts that are dysfunctioning. So one area is ischemia, where your blood vessels are closing down, either because you're old, you were a smoker, you're a diabetic, or you're just unfortunate. Trauma, where you're in a battlefield or in an auto accident, heart attack, stroke, etc. Another big area is organ dysfunction, and we heard some exciting news where people who have bladders that are damaged from radiation, as an example, who had prostate cancer, they can now regrow bladders. There was a famous case in Europe where a person's trachea was regrown right in the laboratory. So we are entering a new era of medicine, and actually a new era for humanity, where we are going to transform the natural existence we have today of whatever the DNA says the number of years we're going to live, that's no longer going to be fixed. And in fact, I see in the future people living longer and living longer and healthier by using cells to treat diseases.
And thanks there to Dr. Andrew Pecora, Chief Medical Officer of the biotech company NeoStem. And a warm thanks there also to Stephen Sprague, an advocate of adult stem cell research.
Laudetur Jezus Kristus. Poslušate slovenski program Radia Vatikan.
Laudetur Jezus Kristus. Jezu Kristuvine studijne.
Ide Vatican Radio. Ella srodakalkum swagadam.
Hamjambo, wasikilizaji wetu wa Afrika Mashariki na Kati.
Hii ni Radio Vatikani ikiwatangazia katika lugha ya Kiswahili.
Laudetur Jesus Christus. Hier ist Radio Vatikan in der Karwoche.
Ever wonder how many languages we broadcast in here at Vatican Radio? Well, a glance at our web pages will give you an idea. Some 45 languages that reach the ears, and now with the internet, the eyes of people across the globe, so that the voice and the teachings of the Pope can reach the four corners. That's a far cry from the less than handful of languages with which the radio began back in 1931.
Laudetur Jesus Christus, المجد ليسوع المسيح.
Recently, Vatican Radio's Arabic program had a change of directors, so I went down the stairs to say hello to my new colleague, Maronite Father Jean-Pierre Yamin from Jouni, Lebanon. Well, before I introduce him to you, I'll tell you briefly that Vatican Radio has had an Arabic program ever since 1949. The year the Arab-Israeli war ended, leaving hundreds of thousands of Palestinians displaced across the region. Father Jean-Pierre tells me that, at first, the broadcasts to the Middle East and North Africa were weekly, but by 1954, they had become a daily feature, especially on the radios and transistors of Christians throughout the region.
نافذتنا اليومية على أهم الأحداث العالمية It started with the ex-Vatican ambassador, Paul Thabet, and then with the ex-Vatican ambassador, Edmond Farhat, and the actual bishop, Burjed al-Hashim, till 1971, when the Maronite Order of the Holy Virgin Mary took the direction of the program.
Okay, and we know that.
And we know that the actual
Patriarch, Bisharai,
was the first director of the Arabic program.
You are also a Maronite priest yourself. Yes. It's always been Lebanese journalists there, or at least a predominance of Lebanese journalists. What does Lebanon have that's so special?
I think that Pope John Paul II has said it all when he said that Lebanon is more than country, it's a message, because as in Lebanon you can find all the religious confession and they quite live happily. So I think this is the point why always the Arabic section have a predominate Lebanese presence.
Because what, there's 17 different 18 now 18 Christian, Muslim, Druze, Jewish, all sorts of denominations, faiths there in Lebanon. So, yes, he did always say that it was a model of conviviality, of cohabitation, of tolerance and respect for the other. Does the Arabic program reach out to non-Christians in some way?
Yes, because we cover all the Middle East area and North Africa, so our audience is Christian and Muslim. And in our program, we have a part for the interreligious dialogue and all the themes about, let's say, this conviviality.
Mm-hmm. So how you work together for social issues, charity, and that sort of thing.
Solidarity,
with the weakest members of society. What do you try to keep in mind when you find you have to report on tense situations, on perhaps even violence between Christians and Muslims? Because you do have sections in your program dedicated to social issues, political issues that are ongoing in the Middle East and North Africa.
Okay. We try always to have the attitude of Christ. You know, as a disciple of Christ, we need to say the truth, even if it hurts sometimes. So we try to be objective and always speaking from the Christian side, from love, forgiveness, and peace.
What direction do you want to take with this Arabic program? It's a moment of dramatic events now in the Middle East, North Africa. What can your program contribute to the future of these regions?
I think that the Middle East, they are not very informed about the church and the activity of the church. Let's say, for example, the last papal visit to Africa was not covered by the press.
The Arabic press.
The Arabic press. There was just a little notice about the physical state of the Pope, that he wasn't in good shape, and just this notice. No one spoke about the visit, what he said, and what was the exhortation about. So I think that the Arabic section in Vatican Radio has done this part, because we have followed all the events one by one, with all the speeches and all the events, taking the highlight of the exhortation to Africa, hoping that it can
have a wider resonance, reach more people.
Yes, because it's a little bit absent. You know, for all the political situation, people are more interested in political than in church news and Pope news. So if we don't do any effort, they won't be informed. So we do what we have to do, hoping that who needs to know can have everything in his hand.
There aren't very many of you working downstairs, so how can you do it?
Yes, we are three right now, and it's a little bit difficult because we need to put more effort and to stay updated with the information. But I think that when someone is taking this not only as a work but as a mission in the church, God gives us the power to do it. I just think about those last 3 days
Of this papal visit to, yes. to Benin, yes.
Yes, it was like a marathon for us.
Oh, I know. We because were working
we are,
all hours,
we are only
too.
Three, mm-hmm. and we started at 8 till 8,
in the
from
evening.
8 to 8. But you are happy to know that you have contributed with something for the people who want to know, who want to be updated. As a priest, I think that for the moment, this is my vocation now. Now my mission is to be a spokesman of the Pope, the Church. This is my new mission, and I hope to do it as God asks.
Who listens to your programs? I mean, you say you go to the Middle East. Your program is heard in North Africa, in Arabic-speaking nations. But, of course, you're also on the Internet now.
Yes.
So anybody in the world can access your programs.
Yes. For sure, I think our family and friends, because when they know that you're working there, so it's like a bit, oh, what have they done today? This is for sure as first audience. And then some Christian in Lebanon, Jordan.
The Palestinian territories.
Palestinian, Jerusalem,
yeah, sure.
mm-hmm. Tunisia, and the press. For example, Zenit, we have like a collaboration between us. So they
With the Catholic News Agency
mm-hmm. Zenit for the Middle East. So they take from us all the news about the Pope and the audiences. So mm-hmm. I think that we're covering
quite a large area.
Quite a large area,
sure.
Yes.
I wonder if your program can impact in some way also the secular Arabic media.
I don't know. It may be. I told you first that all the Middle East mentality is more into politics. So we need to do a great effort. For example, I think we highlighted the exhortation and we did a little service in the audio programs that we have. So the reaction of the society in Africa about this exhortation will reach all the media. So I think in those moments like this, they will come to us because some way we are the Pope voice. So what he really said, what he really wrote, we pass it. So I think only when there's a reaction about an action of the Pope or a message of the Pope, they turn to us.
In his first interview in Vatican Radio studios after becoming pontiff, Pope Benedict XVI said the radio's mission to proclaim the gospel message and be a bridge linking local churches with the Pope and the Vatican is still valid and needed today. And Father Jean-Pierre says Vatican Radio's Arabic program continues to fulfill that mission as a bridge today between Rome and the Christian minority in the Middle East and North Africa, Christians who often feel forgotten by the wider Christian community.
In all societies, you need to have a bridge between the poor, the ignored one, and the rest of the world. So I think this is what the Church is. And this is what our programs are, English or Arabic or French or Italian. Because I think that only the one who needs hope, only the one who needs love, only the one who needs, let's say, to feel alive, will go and look for God and ask for him to be present in his life. And he's interested to know about what is happening now. He wants to be informed and updated about his faith. And this is what we do.
هنا إذاعة الفاتيكان. المجد ليسوع المسيح. لوديتور يسوس كريستوس.
Maronite Father Jean-Pierre Yamin, head of Vatican Radio's Arabic program. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.